It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Toxic is officially 2018's word of the year, according to Oxford Dictionaries. While not a new word, toxic has been used to describe a lot of things in 2018, from the state of politics to certain workplace cultures, and a whole lot more. What do you think about toxic being named as Oxford's word of the year? Good choice? Would it have been yours? What other words do you think deserve some attention and love this year? What new words have recently come to your attention? And what questions do you have about the year's top words and how they're selected? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Three great ways for you to get in touch and share your thoughts on the top words of 2018. Catherine Connor Martin is with us. She's the head of U.S. Dictionaries for Oxford University Press. Catherine, welcome to the morning show. Catherine, are you there? All right, we had her a moment ago. Well, when we get Catherine back, we will be talking about how they pick the words of the year and what goes into that process. And we want to hear from you. If you were picking the top 10 words of 2018, what would they be? Let us know. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That is the number to call to join the program. Email address is ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us. We're on Twitter at WPR Mornings. Again, 800-642-1234. Toxic, the word of the year. I was thinking, it's an agglomeration. It's not really a word. I was thinking post-truth might be another one. But we'll find out why toxic made number one and what the other nine are in the top ten. Want to see what's going on there and find out what you think should be the top words of the year for 2018. Of course, we still have a month and a half to go, but I don't think it's too early to name the top ten for 2018. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning.
How does the Oxford Dictionaries go about selecting a word of the year?
Well, as lexicographers, our job, among other things, is to add new words to the dictionary and to update the dictionary entries to show changes in how language is being used. So all year long, as we're going about our work, we keep this list of potential words of the year. Then as we get closer to the end of the year, we meet and just kind of like you would imagine, thrash it out. We invite lots of people from around Oxford University Press to vote. And it really comes down to kind of a subjective judgment based on the data that we've collected, though, about what is the word that most captures kind of the preoccupations, the zeitgeist of that particular year.
So are there some specific criteria? Are there some, I don't know, numerical thresholds for words to have to cross in order to be considered?
Well, there are many ways in which a word can be the word of the year. So often we will choose a neologism, that is a newly coined word. And when we do that, we try to choose something that has become prominent, like in that year, so that, at the beginning of the year, you might not have heard it, but by the end of the year, it seems very common. This year, it's a little bit different. We're using a very old word in English, but one that has been on an uptick for a long time in extending its usage from this literal meaning of poison into this broader meaning of very harmful and being used in all these social contexts. And we felt like that development had just reached a crescendo in 2018, and we were seeing the word toxic everywhere. It was so pervasive that we felt like once we hit upon that, it was obvious that that was going to be the choice this year.
Well, I mean, toxic isn't a new word. The current entry in the online Oxford English Dictionary dates the word's earliest known printed occurrence to 1664. Why is toxic having such a big moment now?
Well, I think it's not about language so much as it is about culture, or it's the combination of the two. So if we look back at the history of the word toxic, about 100 years ago, it was not a particularly common word in English, much less common than it is now, and it was mainly used only in that very literal meaning, poisonous, and containing toxins. But over the course of the 20th century, the literal meaning of toxic started to be used in some specific combinations and used more often. So the idea of toxic waste came up. And of course, if you think about the 20th century, we have industrialization and many more chemical processes happening and more concern about pollution. And so that literal meaning of toxic starts to be applied in these pollution contexts, and it gets much more common. And alongside that, we see this figurative use of toxic to mean harmful and lots of other ways becoming more common. And it really, in the 80s, we saw the invention of like the toxic relationship, and that comes up in a lot of self-help kind of books in the 1980s, toxic workplaces. But it was still pretty restricted, and that was this kind of self-help language. And it's just been increasing more and more, and we've seen that this becoming a go-to word to describe a whole host of things that happen in our society. 2018, which in the United States and in the UK and some other countries too, has been really characterized by by the Me Too movement, where we talk about toxic masculinity, toxic workplaces. It's been characterized by concerns about literal toxicity with plastic pollution and chemical pollution, and it's been associated with a toxic culture and toxic atmosphere where the polarization that we experience in our society is so profound. So all of those things that you really think of when you think of this year that we've been going through and are still suffering through, they all kind of wrap up with this idea of toxic. So we thought that this was the year where it was really just on everyone's lips.
Well, and I guess going, and this shows my age, going back to maybe something as simple as typesetting, there are fewer letters in the word toxic than there are in poisonous. Is that a consideration?
It could be, but I think what's going on here is, so there's a thing that we study as lexicographers called collocation, and that means how do words fit with one another? And so you can have words that mean kind of the same thing, like toxic and poisonous, but they're not used with the same partner words, and that kind of affects what their meaning is. So if you think about a word like chemicals, sure, you can say poisonous chemicals, but you tend to say toxic chemicals, and that tends to make you think of like industrial waste, or you have toxic waste, toxic byproducts. So it brings up in your mind a sort of host of ideas about the pollution of the environment or the pollution of the body that are sort of fixed. And toxic has then in turn come on in its figurative use to also have these particular associations where it's total chance it could have been poisonous. We could be talking about poisonous masculinity and poisonous workplaces, but for some reason it does have that nice, it's a nice sound. Toxic, it really in the on your tongue, it feels like what it is. You spit it out, sort of. So I think there are a number of things in play.
And one less plosive consonant as well. And then who can forget the classic Britney Spears song that has the word toxic in it, which people may have recognized from our billboard this morning. How often does what's happening in politics drive Oxford's picks for words of the year?
It changes from year to year. This has been a big one, but a couple of years ago, in 2016, we chose post-truth, which was another kind of one that related to the whole political environment. But it's certainly not always the case. We had selfie one year. Vaping was another one. So it really depends. But I think it would be hard to disagree that. Even though many of us wish that we didn't have to think about politics all the time, this has been a year in which it's been very difficult not to.
Absolutely. Catherine Connor-Martin, head of U.S. Dictionaries for Oxford University Press, stays with us. Our toxic conversation continues in a moment on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Oxford Dictionaries have come out with their annual list of top words, and the 2018 winner is toxic. No pun intended. What do you think about toxic being named as Oxford's Word of the Year? Good choice? Did you have some other choice in mind? What new words have recently come to your attention? Share your word stories with us. 800-642-1234. 800-642 1234. You can send us an email. The address is ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Catherine Connor Martin is with us. She is the head of U.S. Dictionaries for Oxford University Press. Catherine, we had a caller who couldn't stay on who wanted to say that fake should be considered for Word of the Year, fake as in fake news. She said that word is all we've heard for the last 2 years or so. Was fake on a previous year's list? Did it make this year's top 10?
I'm trying to remember. I think it's definitely been one that we've discussed. I think last year may have been a breakout year. So sometimes you have one word that, you know, words tend to stay prominent for a long time. 2017 was the year that fake news went from meaning made up news, as it did in 2016 when it first came on the scene, and we were talking about, you know, Macedonian teenagers posting news on Facebook. Last year, during 2017, it came to mean something different, which came to be used as a sort of all-purpose epithet for news that I personally disagree with, and so that was a major change, and that has continued into 2018 as well.
Another word that made the shortlist for Word of the Year is gaslighting, which some would say carries some political connotations these days and also could be classified as toxic behavior. Tell us about this one and why it made the list.
Well, this is another one that I think it has an interesting story because it goes back much further than you might expect. There was a 1938 play called Gaslight. And then that was made into a 1944 movie, which is what really seared this in the public imagination in 1944. So by the 50s and 60s, people were using this is in the play and movie. There's a man who convinces his wife that she's going crazy by dimming and brightening the gas lights in their home at different times. So when she notices this, he manipulates her psychologically into questioning her own sanity. So people picked up on that concept and used it starting in the mid-20th century to mean to psychologically manipulate someone into doubting their own reality or questioning their own sanity. But it wasn't a very common word. And, you know, when I remember, I first encountered it as a lexicographer about 15 years ago, and it wasn't familiar to me at that time, even though it had been in use for quite some time. It was a pretty low-profile word. And then suddenly, in the last year or so, it has gone from being a kind of sleeper word into being this very prominent word that you can see people using every day to describe specifically situations in our mass media where people are seen as denying reality and imposing their view of reality on other people. So you see that a lot. When someone says something that's untrue in the media, people will say, yeah, they're gaslighting us.
Do we, and I guess this might be a little bit of an abstract question, but it is public radio, so I'll ask it anyway. Do you think that that some words just get overused and misused so much that they sort of kind of just lose their meaning altogether? And so it's, I don't know, it's kind of like Kleenex?
Well, you know, it's interesting. English seems to be able to handle a word having many meanings and even sometimes meanings that are opposite of each of them. So the famous example of that would be the word cleave, which can either mean to separate or to hold close together. So humans are actually really good at distinguishing from context which use of a word you mean, even when a word changes over time. I think one of the things that's more deadly to a word or a usage than a changing meaning, which is a natural way that language develops, is trendiness. And so I think what we often see is a word I call these Icarus words, where they come on the scene and it's especially slang. They're so hot that everyone uses them, but then that means they lose their appeal as a slang word because everyone knows them now.
Yeah,
so,
gnarly.
So that yes, exactly. Slang is really subject to this because once your parents understand what the slang means, you can't say it anymore.
Yeah, well, that's just swell. I want to talk about some other words now that made the shortlist for Words of the Year, starting with one that I wasn't familiar with, tech lash. I mean, I know what backlash is, but tech lash, what's that?
Yeah, so tech lash is a negative feeling, negative reaction to the growing power and influence of large technology companies, particularly those based in Silicon Valley. So we saw this come onto the scene at the beginning of this year in a widespread context when people started talking about the Facebook scandals with Cambridge Analytica issues about privacy with Google. And it kind of covers a lot of areas. There's not only how tech companies are, which we always used to give the benefit of the doubt. You know, they were cool and we liked them and they were helping our economy. So people would give a pass to those huge monolithic tech companies. But this year we saw that turn. People were angry about the existence of headquarters in cities like San Francisco raising the prices of rents. People were angry about how their personal information was being used. They didn't trust the tech companies anymore. And with the Amazon H2Q thing that was just announced, that's been part of this too. So a word that has been coined to describe this is techlash. Now, this was actually a pretty strong contender for the word of the year because we felt like that backlash against tech companies was a really strong current this year, and it was something new that we hadn't really seen before. Like, so if you were making a time capsule of 2018, a word time capsule, this would be a good word to have in there. But what we found when we were studying it was that this is still a word that's mainly a journalism word used by journalists to, like, you know, in their article. So they say, do we call this techlash? And it's not really a word that people, ordinary people, use in their daily communications with each other. So for us, that knocked it out of that place, and it's why we felt toxic was a better word this year.
Well, this is techlash would be an example of, I think, what's called a portmanteau, a word that smashes two other words together to create a new one. Do we see a lot of those popping up these days?
That does seem to be a really common and popular way for new words to be created nowadays. Now, of course, that manner of making words goes back a long way. Brunch was coined in the 19th century from breakfast and lunch, and it's stayed with us. So I do think that it has become more common now, and you see people putting these out on social media a lot. A portmanteau word can be almost a punchline or a joke as much as it is a word, and so people will say things, you know, it's like mansplaining comes up as an idea. It's like, it's funny and people laugh at it and they don't necessarily need to use it as a word. Although in that case, that's an example of a smashed together word that people really have been adopting and using widely. So techlash is one of those, and it's not the only lash word. We've been seeing, for instance, white lash come up to describe backlash by white people against what they perceive to be the unfair gains of people of color in society. So that's the lash ending. I would look at that. I see that being used in a lot of contexts, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see more lash words in the coming years.
You've also got over-tourism on the list. I think we can probably guess at this one, but please share the definition with us.
Yeah, so over-tourism is an excessive number of tourist visits to a popular destination or attraction, resulting in damage to the local environment and historical sites and in poorer quality of life for residents. So in the age of Instagram and Airbnb, people will go to some wonderful picturesque spot, they take pictures of it, they make it look so amazing, and it's so easy to get there because now there's much more accommodation available. And so tourists come in droves, and what is generally seen as a good thing by communities, that is, tourists, visitors coming and spending money in their city, starts to become not a good thing. And so that's what over-tourism is. And in various places around the world, localities have been struggling with this lately. So places like Venice or Barcelona have been trying to fight back against what they perceive to be like a level of tourism that's unsustainable and that's making life unpleasant for local residents.
Wow, it's just really hard to keep up. Were there words that didn't make this list that you think deserve an honorable mention?
Yeah, I had a favorite one this year that no one else thought was as interesting as I did, which is YIMBY. So you may be familiar with the word NIMBY, which is an acronym from Not in My Backyard, and it's used to describe people who are opposed to development or the different kinds of upzoning in their own areas. You know, it's fine if you want to build that factory, but don't build it near me. It's fine if you want to build that housing development, but not in my community. Put it in the community two towns over. So this year, a lot more people are living in cities and staying in cities after they have children, and that's resulted in a housing crunch in a lot of urban areas that are popular. And so YIMBY, yes, in my backyard, has emerged, and that's I do want development. Please put more development near me. So I thought that was really interesting.
Cool. Well, we could do this easily for another hour, but we don't have another hour. So I'll just say thank you, Catherine Connor-Martin, for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Catherine Connor-Martin is head of U.S. Dictionaries for Oxford University Press. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Friendsgiving. It can be a fun, quirky way to sneak in two or more Thanksgivings every year. Join us as we map the origins and meaning of this relatively young American holiday. Relatively young being true in more than one way. Do you celebrate Friendsgiving, or have you ever heard of it? Maybe you have heard of it and you don't like it. We want to hear from you. If you do celebrate Friendsgiving, how do you do it? Do you have traditions? When was your first Friendsgiving? How is Friendsgiving different from Thanksgiving for you? Do you make different food, or do you have different activities? Do you celebrate it instead of Thanksgiving, and why is that? You have any advice for people who may be hosting their first Friendsgiving event this year? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ashley Fetters is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Her piece is called How Friendsgiving Took Over Millennial Culture. Ashley, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out by asking you, Ashley, if you celebrate Friendsgiving.
You know, I do celebrate Friendsgiving. Thank you for asking. I started to get invites to Friendsgiving pretty regularly, I would say about 3 or 4 years ago. But I think 2016 is when I attended my first one, and last year I hosted one in my home.
So how did this newish holiday come about? What was the genesis of Friendsgiving?
Well, I think the general consensus among the people I spoke to for this story is that it started as sort of an ad hoc celebration among friends when they found themselves far away from family on the day of Thanksgiving. But it seems to have evolved since then into a tradition that a lot of people do before Thanksgiving, or just in addition to Thanksgiving. Some people do it afterward nowadays. But it's kind of a one holiday with friends, the other with family tradition now. And there's a few theories for why that's happened.
Well, could this holiday may have come about because having Thanksgiving with your friends beats having Thanksgiving with your family, because your family stresses you out?
It's certainly a possibility. I think that it tells us less about why it's so popular just recently, because families have maybe stressed us out always, but it certainly would explain why people do choose it.
Well, and you don't have to deal with that old Uncle Ralph who always makes the inappropriate joke at the table or whatever.
Or you might have to defend Ralph, though.
And on a more serious note here, could some of this be because our families have gotten a lot smaller over time? I mean, we're not having 8 or 9 children anymore, and so there are just fewer family members to get together with on Thanksgiving?
Well, yeah, there are a few different theories as to why this is happening among millennials and why it's happening right now. Obviously, a primary theory is that putting a catchy name on something instantly makes it feel like it's trendier, even if that thing has actually been around forever. Like the words maybe like shorts or bromance or other catchy portmanteaus that sort of made their concepts feel suddenly ubiquitous, even though they've been around forever. Another possible reason that Friendsgiving got so popular is that maybe we're just seeing Thanksgiving sprawl into a season rather than a holiday, a single day holiday, the way that, Christmas or sometimes Halloween do. But like you said, I think one of the more compelling theories as to why Friendsgiving is becoming a thing among millennials right now is that you know, it's a family holiday, but what we consider to be our families and what our families look like is certainly changing. I mean, what we know about millennials is that they, as a generation, we as a generation, I'm a millennial, we tend to delay marriage and join families and being parents into later stages of adulthood than generations prior to us, which, you know, obviously that means more and more of us arrive at a stage in life where we're maybe ready to host our own Thanksgivings or, you know, cook a whole meal that we're very proud of. But the most important people in our lives are our friends.
And for those who've never been to a Friendsgiving, how is it celebrated? Are there specific rituals involved?
One thing that I found when I was reporting out the story is that most Friendsgivings I came across were potlucks. You know, more often you'll see with a Thanksgiving meal with a family that there's like maybe one chef or, you know, two people in the kitchen doing the cooking, or, you know, a select team of people doing it. But on a Friendsgiving, you're more likely to find everybody, you know, gets assigned something ahead of time and brings it on the day of. The other thing that I found to be very fascinating was that it is a holiday that seems very, very dependent on, very fueled by Google spreadsheets or like shared spreadsheets of different varieties so that people can plan and sort of plan around each other in advance so that no one's stepping on each other's toes and you have a well-rounded pre-Thanksgiving Thanksgiving meal.
I'm trying to imagine my late mother looking at a Google spreadsheet to decide what we're going to do for Thanksgiving. I shouldn't even try to think that. My head will explode. Well, let's take a phone call here. Nicole is with us in Oconomowoc. Nicole, good morning. Nicole, hello. Well, I think Nicole must be off checking the turkey or something. But I'll tell you what, our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, actually commented this morning that she'd been to more than one Friendsgiving, and she's all over this. Sarah, if you're next to a microphone, jump in here and tell us about your Friendsgiving experience.
Yes, my Friendsgiving was amazing. It was the first time I hosted. I made the turkey, which was a big deal because I never cook meat ever, and I was terrified, but it was delicious and amazing, and oh my gosh, 10 out of 10, would recommend Friendsgivings. It was a total success.
And how many people were at your Friendsgiving?
I had maybe 20 people in my tiny, tiny little apartment, and it was amazing. We had people, you know, sitting on the floor around the coffee table. We made it work. It was way less formal than like a family dinner would be and very chill. Would recommend. Very good.
And was there a football game on?
There wasn't, but we had vine compilations in the background because we're millennials and we like 7 seconds of entertainment. And then eventually we put on a Yule log video. So really, we just had it was the whole package.
This sounds like a terrific Friendsgiving.
Oh, it was incredible.
And Sarah, you went to a couple others, though, too, didn't you?
Yes, I hosted mine on Friday, and then on Saturday I went to Chicago for a different Friendsgiving, and that one was completely different. It was all vegetarian, everyone had different dishes and very different vibe, but still the essence of Friendsgiving and being with, you know, the family you choose instead of the family you maybe are stuck with some days. And it was great, and I did have a friend who attended three last week. So
wow.
The Friendsgivings are piling up this week for sure.
Awesome. Sarah, thanks. Thanks for jumping in. That's absolutely terrific. Ashley Fetters, Sarah's experience, fairly typical?
Yes, it sounds like a perfect illustration of what people love about Friendsgiving.
Man, I'm starting to feel really left out. I didn't get invited to any Friendsgivings.
You can go to Sarah's next year.
Yeah, maybe. There you go.
Ken,
maybe.
John, you can.
Oh, maybe I'll go to therapy. Let's do a little reset here and ask for some more callers because that's what talk show hosts do. Ashley Fetters is staff writer at The Atlantic. Her piece is called How Friendsgiving Took Over Millennial Culture. And you can join our conversation about Friendsgiving at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email works, although I realize that for some that may be considered an archaic mode of communication. Ideas at WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Again, 800-642-1234. Ashley, how much of this is related to the commercialization of holidays? Our holiday seasons are getting longer and longer. Pumpkin spice lattes appeared in August this year. Christmas starts in October. Do we just kind of have this big mashup?
That's a good question. I think you do see holiday sprawl happen, like you were saying. Fall as a reason for celebration really seems to extend into late summer now, and Christmas, like you said, begins before Halloween practically. But what I would say differentiates Thanksgiving and its its extension, Friendsgiving, is that it hasn't seemed to adopt the commercialization of Christmas or Halloween quite yet. One of my favorite people I spoke to for this story was a Thanksgiving historian, someone who had really looked deeply into the mythology and the origins and the tradition of Thanksgiving. And he had told me that one thing that really seems to be special about Friendsgiving is that it really extends without commercializing the holiday, what it's about in the first place. It's about, creating relationships and fostering them, and it's about inclusion. It's about generosity, and Friendsgiving in that way seems like a very natural extension of Thanksgiving holiday.
Well, I'm a baby boomer, and I've never been to a Friendsgiving. Frankly, I have to admit that until I heard the pitch for this show, I had never heard of it. But my producers, who are all millennials, all observe the holiday. Is Friendsgiving strictly for millennials, or is it only that they're the ones who made it up and they're doing it for now, but maybe the rest of us could catch on to this trend before it dies?
Oh, I think it's very much the latter. I think it's never too late to start doing Friendsgiving. I've found it to be really rewarding, and it's a second way to celebrate a holiday. I can't speak for everybody, but I think a lot of people really love Thanksgiving for what it stands for and for what it means in America and to our families. And, why not celebrate it twice with people that you're very fond of? And what I found, too, is that it's not just, I've tended to associate Friendsgiving with people who might be unmarried or might not have children, but I do want to point out that it's not just unmarried people or childless people who are celebrating Friendsgiving. I talked to some folks for this story who have celebrated 7 years, 8 years, kind of early adopters of Friendsgiving. And one woman told me that she and her friend now, a bunch of them have kids, but what they do is they tend to leave their kids home on Friendsgiving.
Well, that actually might be a good thing in some cases. Ashley Fetters stays with us as our conversation about Friendsgiving continues. Let us know what you think about this holiday. Do you celebrate Friendsgiving? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Ashley Fetters, a staff writer at The Atlantic. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay with us. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Friendsgiving is a relatively new holiday that's been gaining popularity in the last few years. While it might be a way to sneak in two or more Thanksgiving feasts every year, it's also a lot more than that. Do you celebrate Friendsgiving? Maybe you've never heard of it, or maybe you have heard of it and you don't care for it. We'd like to hear from you. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you celebrate it, what's your celebration look like? You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ashley Fetters is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and she's with us to talk about Friendsgiving. Let's take another call. We'll go to Karen in Fish Creek. Karen, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning. Hi. It's really interesting. Friendsgiving is something we've been having for many years up here without even saying it. A girlfriend and myself decided that our families were so blended and interesting, and they included many, many different families of our own children, as well as exes and everybody else. And we're up here in Door County. We have, an interesting season, and there's always a lot of what we call Thanksgiving orphans. So we've been hosting Thanksgiving at the Fish Creek Town Hall and inviting all comers for many years. And so this year, my millennial daughter's like, oh, this is Friendsgiving. And I'm like, really? It's Friendsgiving? Okay, it's Friendsgiving. And so this year we've called it Friendsgiving. And when I heard your show this morning, I'm like, oh, it's really a thing that I don't even know what I'm talking about.
See, now, aren't you glad you tuned in, Karen, so you know that, hey, man, I am really on top of this trend.
Oh, and so not millennial am I. But the truth is, I think that's what Thanksgiving is all about. It's like welcoming lots of people, you know, welcoming your community. I mean, that's what the Pilgrims and the Indians were doing, right? Coming together as a community, not just as a small nuclear 1953 family, but as a community, right?
Karen, thanks for that. The idea of Friendsgiving, and I particularly liked her term Thanksgiving orphans. People like that have been around for a long time. There are always people who don't necessarily have someone, and they often get invited to someone else's family event. But Karen describing something that's been taking place for quite a while. Before I get your comment on that, I want to read an email we got from Amy that's kind of along the same line. Amy writes, in 1997, my college roommate and I hosted our very first Thanksgiving for our friends. This was before the term Friendsgiving. In those days, we essentially threw a party for every occasion, so we had no idea how this particular party would grow and evolve into its own entity that would continue for decades. This past Saturday, we held our 22nd Friendsgiving. About 30 people attended, bringing a dish to pass while we supply the turkey and drinks, and we all give our thanks. It's a wonderful time. So Friendsgiving been around a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, both of those events sound fabulous, and I'd like to go to both of them. So here's something I can invite you to both.
My invitation got lost in the mail, but...
Well, you can come with me. I think this supports the theory that the slapping the catchy label on it made it feel a little bit more ubiquitous just in the last few years. It's the portmanteau theory, right? We're in the golden age of portmanteau, so everything has a catchy little combination name. Like you were saying, I mean, this holiday is all about inclusion. And, you know, from the very start, it was about creating friends, and it was about creating relationships that were meaningful. And as one historian that I spoke to for this story told me, even the first Thanksgiving was aspirationally a Friendsgiving to foster friendships between the Pilgrims and the Native Americans.
We can't have this conversation without talking about class. You interviewed the author of a book about the world millennials have inherited from previous generation, a fellow by the name of Malcolm Harris. Harris had some pretty stunning things to say about Friendsgiving. He called the holiday a propaganda weapon used by the ruling class to further their plans for wage stagnation. Unpack that one for us.
Yeah, that was a fascinating one. I mean, Malcolm's book is very much about situating millennials in the economic situation that we've inherited, and just sort of how the economy has fostered a generation and sort of influenced our behaviors. And I think what he meant by this is that, you know, slapping a cutesy name on something that is in some cases a like scrappier, more thrown together version of the more lavish Thanksgiving spread is sort of celebrating something that he believes to be inferior to Thanksgiving, and sort of inherently or implicitly approving of millennials' lower status in life or lower living standards. You know, that's not everyone's opinion of Friendsgiving, but I did think I thought that was an interesting way to look at it.
Let's talk about Friendsgiving's namesake, Friends. Thanksgiving is traditionally celebrated, or has been traditionally celebrated, with family, often with extended family. In many cases, family we don't see very often. For some people, there can be some baggage associated with that, some stress. So is Friendsgiving then meant to be a less stressful alternative?
It certainly can be, and I mean, I think for a lot of people, it is the less stressful alternative to being with family. And I think, you know, it can also just add some variety to the routine. I think Thanksgiving can be a pretty staid holiday. We tend to do the same meal with the same people every year. And Friendsgiving is just maybe a way to sort of vary things. You know, maybe you'll see different people at your Friendsgiving every year. Maybe you'll bring different things that aren't traditionally on the Thanksgiving menu. So I think, I think it complements Thanksgiving tradition in more ways than just that.
Eat large meal, fall asleep on couch watching football game. Check. Got mm-hmm. those. Yeah, okay. Let's take another call. Mm-hmm. Patrick is with us in Madison. Patrick, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Good morning. So we used to do a different twist on this. I'm also a baby boomer. We would throw a get sick of your relatives party every Thanksgiving and every Christmas. So you go and you hang out with your relatives and you do the traditional thing. And then when you get fed up with them, you get in the car and you go over and you spend the time with your friends at the get sick of your relatives party.
Okay, well, get sick of your relatives doesn't roll off the tongue like Friendsgiving, but maybe maybe that can catch on too. Patrick, thanks for that call. Do you think Friendsgiving, Ashley, is a trend, or is this going to evolve into its own full-blown holiday and with cards and everything?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't have a real, like, holiday Thanksgiving crystal ball in front of me, so it's hard to say. But given the way things are going, I do think it's here to stay, at least for the moment. I wouldn't be surprised if for the next few years we continue to see Friendsgiving dominate our Instagram feeds and our Facebook invites, at least for the next few years.
It might actually crack the top 10 for the Oxford English Dictionary's Words of the Year as well. And it,
oh, wow. That's a great call.
That would be great if it would replace a word like toxic. But I guess what I was suggesting is how long is it before someone's going to figure out how to commercialize the idea of Friendsgiving, do you think? A matter of seconds,
I'm sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm already starting to see more and more publications, especially those that are sort of service-oriented around cooking and around hosting, sort of capitalize on here's how to host your own Friendsgiving, how to be the best Friendsgiving host, how to have the best Friendsgiving this season. So I'm sure it's, like you said, a matter of moments.
Do you think that some of this might be, we mentioned our families are smaller, maybe we go to church less often. There's a lot of the traditions that used to be associated with Thanksgiving just aren't there anymore. Do you think that might be what we're looking at here?
I think that might be it. Yeah, I think that's a piece of it. And I also think, Thanksgiving is so fond to so many people that, you know, there is a theory that I have where, you know, you end up at a stage in life where you, you know, would like to be in charge of a Thanksgiving. You've ended up at that point in your life where you can host one and you have all the capacities and the skills and the equipment to host a meal, but you're not really in a position within your own family, or you don't have a family of your own yet to sort of flesh out the tradition in the traditional way. And so I think it creates an opportunity to sort of fill in the framework with friends.
You get to try it out just like Sarah did. Ashley Fetters,
yes.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, John. It's been fun.
Ashley Fetters, staff writer at The Atlantic. She wrote a piece titled How Friendsgiving Took Over Millennial Culture. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.